Welcome to Questions from the Closet. I'm Charlie Bird.
And I'm Ben Shalati. Each episode, we discuss a question we're commonly asked as LGBTQ plus Latter-day Saints.
We're not trying to answer this question or come to a consensus, but simply sharing our perspectives. Today's question is, how do I work through past statements from church leaders?
So Charlie and I are not terribly diverse. We share many opinions and life experiences. For example, we both love to drink milk.
However, there are some pretty big differences. For example, I recently learned that Ben has never milked a cow.
That's true.
I definitely have milked a cow.
I don't know like in which situation I would have had to milk a cow.
It's starting to sound like you didn't grow up on a farm in Missouri.
I didn't. I grew up in suburban Washington.
Milking a cow was like so fun conceptually. And then you do it and you're like, oh my gosh, I hate this. And you have to just keep doing it.
Well, is that dangerous? Like the cow can kick you.
Yeah, but just like, don't be stupid. Like, you don't, like, mess around behind the cow. Okay. It can be, yes, it's very dangerous, Ben.
Okay.
Mostly it just, like, cramps your hands. Luckily, so we didn't have dairy cows, but, like, my family did and friends did. And you just have to, like, at 5 a.m. and in the evening, you, like, have to milk the cow.
Otherwise, they die.
Yeah, they get sick or, I don't know, it depends on the cow. But it's just, you gotta milk the cow.
Every day.
Yeah. But it's fun because sometimes you can, like, squirt it into a cat's mouth and it's like...
The cats just hang out?
Yeah, they just catch it.
That sounds kind of fun.
Like barn cats.
Maybe I should milk a cow.
You should milk a cow once. It's not very dangerous. You're going to be fine.
All right. Well,
especially the cow wants to be milked.
Okay, well, maybe if the situation arises. As much as I love milk, I don't really drink it, though.
Why?
Is it
because you live with a 90-year-old woman?
Well, I do have to check the expiration date on the milk.
That's not what I meant. Whoa. I just meant that she like might not like a glass of milk.
Oh, no. I just don't drink a glass of milk. I usually drink water. But I have cereal every day for breakfast, usually.
No.
And we drink whole milk.
Yeah, whole milk. Anything less, I'm like, why are you putting water in milk?
Yeah. Have you seen Napoleon Dynamite?
Yeah.
There's like the best pickup line in that movie where Napoleon's like, I forget the girl's name. Deb? Deb's her name. Uh-huh. Yeah. He's like, Are you drinking skim milk because you think you're fat? Because you're not. You could totally drink whole milk.
Ben, if you think that's the best pickup line, you really need to go out more.
That is probably true. I think it's very sweet and milk related. There we go. I like milk. I've never milked a cow. Bad at pickup lines. So we like to provide a variety of voices and perspectives. So today we're joined by Barbara Jones Brown.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello, Barbara. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I like milk.
Oh, yeah?
What kind? And I drink whole milk.
Good.
Oh, nice. Why drink anything else?
Sorry for the lactose intolerant listeners, but I feel for you.
Or the vegans.
Oh. I grew up on a farm that's like not even in my vocabulary.
The least vegan place to grow up. Anyway, Barbara, tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm a historian. I specialize in a lot of Mormon history, and recently I published a book called Vengeance is Mine, the Mountain Meadows Massacre and its Aftermath. So a very trying topic from...
Yeah, like heavy stuff.
Very heavy stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And who did you work on that book with?
So my co-author was Richard E. Turley Jr., and he was the assistant church historian at the time when we were working together. He is doing other projects now. Mm-hmm. And I also edited the first book of the series, which was called Massacre at Mountain Meadows.
Okay, which one is the must read if we had to pick between the two?
If you have to pick between the two, definitely Vengeance is Mine.
It's got a really nice title.
Isn't it a great title?
I'm like, ooh.
I love that title, and there's a reason why we chose it. It actually, maybe I should back up and explain what the Mountain Meadows Massacre was and then explain why we chose that title.
Sure.
Great. Yeah, please.
So it's a tragic... a horrific episode in the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In 1857, a group of Mormon militiamen in southern Utah massacred a group of California-bound immigrants. I learned about this first in the 90s from my father, and it was shocking to learn about. So I don't know if any of your listeners are going to learn about it for the first time. But there's no excuse for it, but it is important to understand the historical context, to understand how something as horrific as that could happen. So Vengeance is Mine covers the massacre and then also its aftermath. And we delve deeply into all of the motivations, all of the things, the historical context that led to this horrific thing happening. So it's a very tragic part of Mormon history. Mm-hmm. So the reason why we came up with the title of Vengeance is Mine is in 1859, a group of army men come through and they come into the Mountain Meadows. They gather up the remains.
This is 2 years after?
This is about a year and a half later, almost 2 years. And they create a mass grave for the remains of those people. And
oh gosh, they just left them out there.
They buried some and others they didn't. And then scavengers came in.
Oh gosh.
And dragged the bodies across the valley. And anyways, this army contingent came in and they created a mass grave of stones. And then out of the stones, they put a cedar cross. And across the crossbar of the cross, they wrote, "Vengeance is mine and I will repay, saith the Lord."
Mm.
And so that's where the title comes from. It's actually deeply related to the book. And also the theme of vengeance is all throughout the book as well. People talking about vengeance, because of course, after this happens, people want vengeance on the Latter-day Saints. And there's even talk of genocide, wiping out all of the Latter-day Saints. And so it's a heavy topic.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And how did you get involved in that project?
So I was working as an editor for the Ensign magazine years ago. I majored in journalism at BYU. And I was...
Is that how you met your husband?
His sister lined us up because he was a journalist. And I was working for the church's magazine and he was working for the church's newspaper. And so his sister thought, oh, wouldn't it be cute if we line him up?
And indeed it was.
Yeah. And the rest is history. So... but I would write a lot of articles about the church history department and the family history department, what was going on in those departments. And Richard Turley happened to be the head of those. So I was always calling to fact check with him. And so I later turned in a resume to the church history department because I was interested in doing freelance. I was starting to get interested in history. And he liked my work before. So he called me and, make a long story short, he had me come in and interview for the position. And then I edited his first book. And then with the second book, I decided I didn't want to just edit historians. I wanted to be a historian. So I went back to grad school and got my master's in history at the University of Utah. And then co-authored volume 2, Vengeance is Mine, with Greek.
That's really cool.
You know, a lot of the people we have on the podcast are just like friends I know and like people I know. And you're one of the people I didn't know before today and just like reached out to. So I'm so honored because you're way too important to be here in my basement.
No, not at all. I was so honored when I heard from you. I'm like, I love your podcast and I'm just thrilled to be here with you. So thank you for inviting me.
Of course.
So as a church historian, I imagine you're interacting with a lot of difficult and complex things from church history. And especially coming from like top church leaders. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, and I should also say that I am now director of Signature Books Publishing. So I continue to edit historical books and write historical books. So yeah that's my jam.
How has that changed your view of like your faith, the church, religion, I guess membership, culture?
I think for me, I've never been one to think that church leaders were perfect. I've never been one to think that prophets, presidents of the church were perfect people. I've always thought of them as men, as human beings that were capable of making mistakes. And so for me, let's take the example of Mountain Meadows. When I read violent rhetoric that Brigham Young was preaching at the time, it was stunning. It was surprising. But at the same time, I wasn't like bowled over because I was like, well, he's a man capable of making mistakes, as I think all church leaders are. And church leaders will tell you, I am a human being doing my best and I'm capable of making mistakes. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And a big question I have for you is what kind of responsibility do you feel for the people of the past that you write about and research?
Right. So it's important. Historians are trained to look at all of the viewpoints of the people and the events that you're writing about. So you should never make anyone a one-dimensional character because people aren't one-dimensional, whether they're dead or alive, right? So it's important to try and cover all aspects of a person and try and get at their motivations by sharing their quotations from their words and sharing what people write about them, and never make somebody all black-hatted or all white-hatted, but just portray people as the humans that they were.
Mm-hmm. How does like cultural zeitgeist play into something, I guess, like the Mountain Meadows massacre? Like, what else was going on at the time that led to this like eruption of violence?
Exactly. So with every historical event, there's always context. And again, historians, that's our craft, is to look at the context of what was going on to understand people's motivations that led them to do something as horrific as the Mountain Meadows Massacre, for example. So in 1857, the president of the United States, his name was James Buchanan, he was receiving word that the Latter-day Saints were in rebellion. They were practicing polygamy. They were forming alliances with Native Americans, which is, of course, they saw as their spiritual mandate, as appears in the Book of Mormon, right? But if you weren't LDS, you would be very suspicious at that time in the 19th century of white folks befriending, baptizing, forming relationships with Native Americans. So there was suspicion about that. And also there was a theocracy in Utah. Brigham Young was not only the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he was also the governor of the territory. And so there wasn't the separation of church and state that we think of in a democracy today. So all of those reasons led Buchanan to be suspicious of Young, thought he needed to replace him, and thought, oh, I need to send an army with him to ensure that there's no rebellion in this. The Latter-day Saints had recently been driven from Missouri and Illinois in the prior two decades. They were suspicious of the troops coming. Make it a long story short, this led to an atmosphere of war hysteria, of fear, and various things led to conditions in which this war atrocity took place. And if people want to like delve deeply into it, I encourage them to read Vengeance Is Mine, because we delve very deeply into these
things. That's really interesting. So it sounds like on one side, like the church was going against American values.
Exactly. Because like, American values were monogamy.
Right.
And democracy. And the Latter-day Saints were practicing polygamy and theocracy.
So there's like a fissure there. And then on the other hand, I imagine the saints having just been like driven out of multiple places probably felt really like super persecuted, super like hyper vigilant about like, we need to like stand up for ourselves. And like, exactly. We finally built up this place.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Very threatened. Yes. And Brigham Young says, when he hears that the troops are coming to the Salt Lake Valley, he says, I feel to be oppressed no more. Like, we're not going to be driven again. We're going to stay here.
Yeah, even a lot of the pioneer hymns are like about that sort of like, we're free and we won't be oppressed.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts, and maybe yours too, Ben. And this is kind of where we're probably going to start applying this to what a lot of our listeners are going through, which is harmful or painful things that church leaders have said in the past mm-hmm. about being gay or about the LGBTQ mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. And just trying to like figure out how that fits within faith and within the church. I'm curious though, as you were talking about like this, what you said was violent rhetoric that Brigham Young had, like some of his quotes that you were reading and like acknowledging that he was a man who made mistakes. How does that fit with the idea that prophets are the mouthpiece of God?
Yeah, that's can be troubling, right? Like, how do we know when is that God's voice and when is that their opinion? But there are because they are prophets or church leaders, how do we know the difference, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We grow up kind of like, and maybe it's just like the simplicity of like teaching primary. It's like God speaks mm-hmm. to a prophet and the prophet relays that message mm-hmm. to us. And there's like even primary songs that we sing, like follow the prophet, like you won't be led away if that happens. So like, what do you do when you've listened to something that a prophet or an apostle or church leader has said and it actually has been harmful to you? Or your family.
I think that's where the Spirit comes in. I think that's where your personal relationship with God comes in, and prayer. And you know what God is telling you is right. And if there's something that's said that you know is not right, then you trust that. I'll share a different example if it's okay. But yeah. I have a lot of friends who are Black Latter-day Saints. And I've heard countless numbers of them talk about when they used to pray about the priesthood ban, the priesthood and temple ban for church members. They would pray and they'd say, God, why would you curse me like this? Why would you have this policy? And every single one of them that I heard talk about this in separate venues would say, I would always get the answer back, I didn't ever put that policy, that isn't from me.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They'd all get that same answer and they would trust that. And then now, thanks to historical research that's been done recently by Latter-day Saint historians, we now know that that was never considered a revelation, the priesthood ban. It was a policy, it was a political decision that was made in the 1850s by Brigham Young and the Utah legislature. It was a political thing. And so I think of my Black Latter-day Saint friends, they were trusting what they were hearing from God. And God was telling them, that didn't come from me.
Yeah. What are you thinking, Ben?
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, you talked about like the context and the like the zeitgeist, like the environment that's happening around all these things. And there's this really interesting moment in the Book of Enos, which is quite short, where Enos has this beautiful prayer and then he feels remission for his sins and he prays for his brethren, the Lamanites, which is such a lovely thing to do. And then a few verses later, he describes them as like filthy and loathsome. Mm. And it's so odd that he like prayed for these people and then clearly he had his own personal feelings and described them that way.
Bias there.
Yeah. And I think that we all are subject to biases and perspectives that are incorrect. And as we learn and grow, we will hopefully like shed ourselves of those, but none of us are going to be totally free of bias. So let's switch over to the LGBTQ stuff and past statements from church leaders there. And Troy, I thought it'd be cool if you read a bit of something from your book that you wrote about this.
Yeah. In my first book, Without the Mask, this was something that I was really, like, I really wanted to touch on because it's something that had really impacted me. Mm-hmm. Growing up there, I didn't really have resources or anyone to look to in terms of like, what should I do with these feelings that I'm having, which I thought were like all bad. And so the stuff I would look into was kind of like what we now consider outdated, but it's all I really had at the time. And so growing up, like from the age of 14, I started reading about same-sex attraction and what it means to be gay from a church perspective, because I really wanted to like hold on to what the prophet was saying. And the things I read were devastating to me. They made me feel just like awful. And but I believed them. And so it kind of like turned into a lot of self-hatred. Anyway, after I had like realized this wasn't going to change, I was probably like 22 years old. I was in college and I started to become obsessed with all of those statements that had used to hurt my feelings. And I started keeping like a log of them in my phone. And it was like into the hundreds. Mm. And other people had done the same thing. So I looked at, you know, like Wikipedia pages helped and people's blogs helped and like conference talks. And I just like was amassing this thing. And I was reading it like every night and just kind of like, so I was mad. I was so, so angry.
And what did it do to you to constantly be in that?
Well, do you want me to read it? I kind of feel weird. Like, so here's an excerpt from Without the Mask.
I've recorded a whole audiobook. Yes.
I'm in chapter 9 on page 92, if you're following along at home.
get your scripture marking pencils.
So what had happened was I came out to my buddy Sayre, and we were on a road trip, and it was a great coming out experience. And then we started talking and I kind of like, he said something that he said, he was like, everyone has challenges. I was like, this isn't just a challenge. Like, don't go there. And so then it got tense. Right. Oh. And then I said, like, everyone's just going to see me as like this dangerous, defective perversion. Like, I can't come out because it'll just like put this target on my back. And he was like, where do you get that idea? And I was like, let me tell you. So I pulled up this list. It says, I say, look at these quotes. I began to read them aloud. This one, where simply being attracted to the same sex is called a malady and a detestable crime against nature. Or this one that says if anyone has same-sex attraction, then they haven't prayed hard enough. And I went to talk about how as I read these, I remember this moment. I was just like, it was boiling inside me. I said, all I ever wanted was to feel close to God, but these quotes made me feel like he wouldn't want me. This is what people know about being gay. This is what everyone around me has been taught. They were leaders. They were supposed to be helping. My heart broke as I dug into my pain. I felt a hard shell of anger trying to envelop me, and I let it. They put being gay up with rape and child molestation. They accredited homosexuality to early sexual abuse, bad parenting, and unhealthy family dynamics. They suggested I could be cured with invasive therapy methods. So yeah, how am I supposed to compete with that? No matter what I do, this is how people will see me. Thoughts, Ben?
First of all, I'm so sorry, Charlie. That is like, that's so heavy.
It is. It's
made me cry.
It's reality when you're gay. When you grow up gay in the church, that's just the reality.
Yeah. Barbara, where's your emotion coming from? Like hearing
that? Well, just caring about you as a human being. Like, no human being should ever feel that way. Ever be made to feel that way. And of course, I have family members, my stepson, cousins, dear friends who are LGBT, and I love you all. And it made me think about identities, you know. So I just shared an example about Black Latter-day Saints being made to feel that they were less than or cursed, right? I've felt feelings at times as a woman, as a female, being not as good as, or not enough. And it just made me think of how no one should ever be made to feel less than or not good enough or not worthy or as acceptable as someone else because of our identity, whatever our identity happens to be, right? I think we all need to be affirmed in our identities.
Mm-hmm. Or like thwarted in the plan of salvation.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, listening to you read that, just how different I think my experience was with those kinds of things. I just have way too much confidence. Like, I was just born with too much confidence, probably. And all the things that were hard for me were things I heard actively. Like, there weren't things that I like found in like past things.
Well, I think it's the same thing though.
Right.
Because the point I was making here is that everyone in society believes these things about me because leaders have told them that's the truth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think like the source of so much of my pain was these things that a handful of church leaders had said and like taught from the pulpit that were then like codified into people's testimonies individually. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So did you, as you were like reviewing all those, did you believe them yourself?
Me right now?
No, like at the time, like at the time that like the book takes place and you were talking about that there.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I wrote this when I was younger, I had buried myself in these words. Mm-hmm. Now thinking about how damaging that was filled me with rage. Mm-hmm. So it kind of switched where earlier I was like, oh, I can do this. I can change. I need to pray harder. I need to work harder. This is gross. Don't talk to gay people. And then once I like really accepted the reality of who I am, I was really mad because I was like, these are wrong.
Yeah. And I think you just highlight what so many of us go through when we encounter these statements from church leaders, where it makes us feel inadequate. Like, it makes us feel like we need to do more. And that causes feelings of shame, self-hatred, and all that. And then if we get to a place where, you know, I don't believe that anymore. Like, I don't believe that if I just pray hard enough, my orientation is going to change. Like, I don't believe that this is a perversion. Then it makes us mad.
Yeah.
Because that's how we're treated and what we're told.
And it pops that bubble of like, things are simple, right? I think I grew up thinking that like the church was really simple and that church leadership and the structure of it was perfect, right? I thought like if the prophet says something and you do it, you'll be blessed. And exact obedience brings blessings. But for me, in this aspect of my life, exact obedience to these teachings made me suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really shocking to the system. And then it pulls into that space of like, well, if this is wrong, what else is wrong? And then there's like this whole like unraveling. And I think it goes really into black and white thinking quickly. It's like, oh, if that's bad, then it's all bad. Or I'm bad. It's either I'm bad or the church is bad. Which one is it? And in my experience, it was just way more complex than that.
And then when you're in like this tender space of trying to figure yourself out and you're confiding in people and they say, Ben, well, you seem to have faith. Like, if you pray harder, this will go away. Like, I remember that happening and then getting really upset at my friend for saying that. But also thinking, oh, but she hasn't been thinking about this for as long as I have. And like, why wouldn't she think that? And like being mad and like trying to offer grace to the person who just hurt me.
Mm-hmm. So what feelings are coming up for you?
I just wish things were different. This makes me sad.
Well, I think things are different now.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. You had a thought.
Yeah. You know, I just wish that I wish I could have grown up in a world where I didn't have to deal with the word perversion.
Oh, yeah.
And the word abomination.
Yeah.
But I remember I read The Miracle of Forgiveness for the first time when I was 24. And I'd already worked through a lot of stuff. So I remember there's a whole chapter on homosexuality. I remember reading that and just thinking, oh, yeah, I don't believe that.
Right.
And like I'd gotten to that place when I was 24.
Mm-hmm.
But my friend had given it to me and had told me it was the best book he'd ever read and it had changed his life. And I thought, oh, what would my friend think about me if he knew?
Yeah.
And so yeah, I just wish I didn't have to worry about that. You know, it has caused and continues to cause a lot of stress.
Yeah.
Because there's a statement I heard from Brene Brown, same Brene Brown some people call, where she said that the past remains in the present until it's processed.
I absolutely believe that. Yeah.
And I feel like I've processed a lot of these feelings personally, but as a people, I don't
think it hasn't been processed.
We haven't done that. And so I can do the work, but that doesn't mean, but now I'm going to a new ward. I'm going to start going to my neighborhood ward soon, which I'm very excited about. But I don't know what these people think about homosexuality. Like, I don't know I don't know what books they've read or statements they've held on to.
Does that matter to you?
It matters that I could be mistreated.
Yeah.
And I'm strong enough to like handle that and like have a conversation and like offer someone grace and the opportunity to learn. Like, I can do all that, but it doesn't mean I'm not a little nervous when I walk into a new space for the first time.
It's still an extra burden.
Yeah. But like, I'll be fine. And I'll win over anyone who doesn't like me in my ward. So, but still, it's like,
that's the fun response. Okay.
Who wouldn't like you, Ben? I mean that.
Yeah. But still, like,
you'd
like,
be surprised.
But yeah, we'd give you a list. Like my new bishop, I don't know anything about him. And I don't know if what he's going to think about me having like a rainbow wristband. Like, he might ask me not to do that. And I just don't know. And so there are these these things from the past live on, and they don't live on in me personally, but they live on in my community
in interactions,
and that affects me personally.
Yeah.
And so I like, as you read that, it's just like, ugh, I remember feeling that way, and I also know that there are people who still see me that way.
Yeah. So I think when we're talking about how to work through some of this stuff, it's kind of already, I'm seeing like two different prongs. Whereas one, it's like, how do you work through it personally? And the second, how do you work through the remnants that still exist? And we were talking earlier about just like cultural context and the context of the time. And I think it's really interesting because right now, currently in 2024, it's the cultural views around like gay people, gay marriage are all over the place. Whereas before, when these quotes were said, were like pretty standard for the everywhere, right? These were really standard quotes. It wasn't just church leaders saying these things. It was psychologists. Like in the DSM-5, being gay was considered like a mental disorder.
It was like the DSM-3, DSM-5.
Sorry. In the DSM, the diagnostic manual. You're so right. Thank you. That's just the one that's in my office because it's the most current.
You have a printed copy?
Yeah.
I just use the internet.
So anyway, it's just interesting because like when these things were said, I'm sure people were like, oh yeah, duh. Like, right. That's right.
That's historical context.
Right.
You know what, you know, those kinds of quotations that you just shared, that was part of the historical context. That's recent history, of course, but it is historical context. And I think we can see how things have changed and are changing. And I listening to you two and seeing your examples as a historian, sorry, I might get emotional, but I have felt as a historian that someday historians will be writing about you and what you have done. I don't say that lightly. I really believe that. I've been thinking that before I even met you is that it's true, you guys.
I hope they get it right.
You are the change makers, you and others like you in this area. You are the change makers, and someday you will be in history books. I firmly believe that. So
that's nice.
And they'll all pronounce Shalati wrong.
I think my last name's four letters and a very common animal.
So, yeah, you can just see, and that's what historians do, is we look at how things change over time. And I'm 56, so I can say how things have changed in my lifetime longer than you two have been around, but I can see a dramatic change. And not to downplay how hard and difficult things still are.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we have so far to go.
Yeah. Again, there's like a lot of complexity to this. It's not good and bad or right or wrong. There's like a lot of digging you have to do. I think talking about like how to work through this, I think you have to work through it personally before we can work through it as a society. Yeah. If that makes sense.
I mean, I think it could go both ways, because people could lead out and help us as a culture.
That's what I mean.
To process things.
So can I share how I worked through a lot of this personally for me?
Yeah.
So I'm going back to this story in my book. I had kind of read these quotes to my friends, and he was like, stop. And I was like, no, look at this. Like, look at my phone. Read these yourself. And he was like, ew, I don't want to read that. Like, get it away from me.
And this was a straight friend?
Yeah, this is a straight friend. And we had and still do have a really close relationship. So I was like, just look at these. And he was like, no, dude, like, stop this. He was like, how often do you read this? And I was like, like, a lot. Like, every night I'm obsessing over these quotes. And he was like, Charlie, like, why are you wasting your time? And do you believe any of these words? And I was like, of course not. Like, not at all. And he's like, does reading them make you better? Does it inspire greatness or change in you? And I was like, really? Like, I was close enough to him that I was like, I could be called out and it didn't feel like an invalidation. And I was like, no, actually, like, you're right. And we kind of went back and forth, and I was like, but look what it did to me. And he's like, look, Charlie, like, you can carry these with you, and you can live there, and I'll support you in that. But that's not, I don't see it positive. I don't see any positives from this. And if you don't want people to have these at the top of their mind, you need to like prove them wrong, I guess. Just don't even allow them space. And this is what he said. He said, it doesn't matter to me what other people think or what other people have said. I grew up in the same church as you, and I see you for who you are. You are virtuous, you are good, and I trust your goodness. Other people will be able to see that as well. I can't imagine how hard this must be for you. I feel unworthy to even try. But if you keep looking for reasons to hate, you're going to find them. Maybe you'll feel powerful and validated for a little while, but eventually you'll end up vindictive and bitter. If you want things to change, if you want this cycle to really stop, you can't fight hate with hate. You can't sit in any bitterness. You have to forgive. It might take everything you have. It might be the hardest cross you'll ever have to bear. But you have to forgive, or you'll never be able to heal. You have to have faith that others will recognize you for who you truly are, not based on these outdated perceptions. You have to find a way to let it go, or you'll never be happy. And, you know, I was at that moment, I was just thinking, like, I don't know if I can let this go. This is like influenced so much of my life. But I sat there and we just sat in silence for a while. And I was like, you know what? You're right. Like, you are right. Thank you. And I deleted the list. And I felt really somber about it. It felt really like a meek thing to do. But I remember in that moment thinking about Christ, who was lied about and spat upon and literally like tortured and murdered. And the last, like with his dying breath, he used it to forgive the people who murdered him. Mm. And I was like, oh, gosh, like that is the well I want to draw from. That is truth. That is goodness. And I just remember thinking, if I'm not ready now, but if Christ can forgive his murderers, then I can forgive these church leaders because they didn't know. Like, they didn't know what they were doing to me. And I believe that. It's hard. It's hard to hear. And I think even saying this, I know there's people who will be like mad at me and like thinking that I should call for accountability. And I think accountability is important, but there has to be forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And you can't hold people to what they thought when they didn't know, you know?
Yeah. I mean, God is the one who will judge. And so it's not us for us to judge. It's us. It's us. We're called to forgive all men.
Yeah. And I really did see that the more I was focusing on that, the worse my life was. Mm-hmm. And by clearing it out, I was able to let things go and just move forward and not really be paranoid about who might be thinking what about me. Mm-hmm. She's like, I don't care what people think about me. Like, I know I'm good. So I'm just going to show up good.
And God knows you're good.
Yeah.
Barbara, can you walk us through what it was like for you to like dig into this like really tragic event in church history and the trauma involved and like what that was like for you and also ways that you found healing and reconciliation? It's a very big question I just asked.
So I was thinking of you, Charlie, when you were just talking about like wallowing in these things of the past. And of course, I don't want to compare my experience to yours because you're talking about your very identity, right? I'm just talking about something that was painful in
your religious
in
identity.
History.
That's still a big deal.
My religious identity. But in my case, my people were the perpetrators of the crime. I wasn't a victim as these kinds of things did victimize you. You're a survivor of those things, but they were victimizing for you as you describe what it was like as a youth to grow up being told those things about yourself. So when I first started on this project, and I just started reading all of the primary sources and the horrific accounts of this mass murder. And I was doing that because I wanted to make sure we told the truth and got it all out. And so I had to engage with these horrible things, right? And it was devastating for me. I was often crying at my desk. I was so glad I had a door I could close because I would just find myself just sobbing at my desk. I'd be driving home from work and sobbing. I had little tiny girls at the time, and I would see their heads covered with blood as I was combing their hair. I mean, I was just like really having PTSD-like symptoms, mm-hmm. Just from studying this horrific event. But
can I make a note?
Sure.
It sounds like it's from like personalizing the event.
Yes, because I would put myself there.
Exactly.
And I don't know if that's because I'm just a very, visual person as a writer. I just wanted to put myself in the shoes of those who suffered. Yeah.
I think when we talk about hard things, it's easy to like generalize it or like put it away from us, mm-hmm. and like talk about it as if it's a fact.
Maybe a little bit like your friend with these quotations.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Like, I don't want to hear that.
He didn't have like the emotional connection to it. And so like allowing yourself to step into that emotional place and feeling the hit mm-hmm. of oppression or violence or, hard things.
It makes you feel compassion for people who have been hurt.
Yeah, right? Even 160 years later.
Yes, absolutely.
It doesn't sound like that long ago. Like, really, when I there's
it's three what three four generations ago.
Yeah, that's like pretty recent.
Yeah. So, anyways, I was really suffering, but I wanted to do it because I wanted to tell the truth about what happened to these people who were victims.
Yeah.
And I was always saying to Rick, I would go into his office. This is when I was working on the first volume, Massacre at Mount Meadows. And I would say, I don't know what it is, but I just feel compelled to meet descendants of victims. I've really got to meet descendants of victims. I would say that over and over again somehow. And then I remember once he says, oh, well, the descendant of Alexander Fancher, who was one of the train leaders, and a descendant of John Twitty Baker, who was the other leader of the train, they're coming up to meet with Elder Marlin K. Jensen, who was a church historian at the time. After he meets with them, you can meet them then. So I remember I went and I was just like waiting outside the door. And as soon as the door opened and they walked out, I grabbed their hands. They didn't know me. And I said, hi. And I said, I just want you to know that your ancestors were good people. And I'm so sorry for what happened to them. And they looked at me. I was surprised by this, but they looked at me and they started crying. And then I started crying, and they just hugged me and said, thank you. And then one of them invited me out. It was 2007, and they were having a 150th reenactment of their people, of their ancestors, leaving Arkansas for Utah. They left in the spring of 1857, and they invited me to come. So I went, and there were descendants of all the different family groups there. And they said to me, so who do you descend from? I said, oh, no, and I'm just a Mormon from Utah. Their eyes got really big, and it was kind of like, what are you doing here? And I was stunned to discover that there was still so much anger and hurt there. But because I was angry and hurt by what I was learning as well, because I put myself in the victim's shoes, I was able to sit with their anger. Yeah. And just listen to them. And then I would just say, I'm so sorry for what happened. And it was the same reaction every time. Just, well, thank you. I've never heard a Mormon say that. Thank you.
This is a really humble thing for you to do. To not try to like defend or be like, well, that wasn't me. That I didn't do it. Just why are you mad at me? That, you know, I wasn't involved. That's really humble.
And I think it's because, again, because I was studying the history of it. Mm. And so I got why I related not with the perpetrators of the crime. I related to the women immigrants who were massacred trying to defend their children. I was putting myself in their shoes.
And when you were apologizing, were you saying like, I'm sorry, like for my people, or like, I'm just sorry that you're in pain?
I just said, I'm just so sorry. That's all I said. But I was sincere. And they'd say, wow, I can tell you're sincere. Thank you for saying that. And they'd say, I've never heard a Mormon say that before. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking of, you know, you reading those quotes, I just want to tell you, Charlie, and Ben, I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't say those things, but I'm still sorry that you had to experience that. I think all of us need to say sorry more for people when they suffer pain. You know, and that's why it's so important to study history. And actually, I think it is important for those of us who want to be allies, to study that history and study those horrible things and learn about what it was like to feel that way. And I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's really nice.
That way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But what I found was I was stunned that I actually got better. Like, all those PTSD-like symptoms I was suffering were gone. And it was because I realized there was something I could do for those victims from 150 years ago. I could do something for their descendants and help heal their descendants from their pain. And so we would ask the descendants of victims, what can we do for you? And they'd say, tell the story so people don't forget what happened to them, so they know the truth of it. So that's why we do the book. That's why I speak about Mountain Meadows as much as I do. And then they said, protect the land where our ancestors' remains still lie today.
Yeah.
And so we worked with them to achieve National Historic Landmark status for the Mountain Meadows. So that is protected in perpetuity now.
You know, the way I actually learned about this, I'd like heard people talk about it, but I was driving south to a cabin and we like passed... And there was a marker.
Uh-huh.
I think it was like a directions marker. Yes. And I was like, oh, I wonder what that is. So I just Googled it and like read the story. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So it's working.
Yeah.
Like even just having that land protected.
Yes.
Tells the story.
And if you ever want to go back, I'll take you there and give you a tour. I'd be happy to do that for you too anytime. So
one thing you said that I thought was really fascinating was how these like PTSD symptoms decrease once you started doing something.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the sense of powerlessness is what gave it so much power over you.
Exactly.
And I relate that to my experience too. Like as I felt powerless, and even now, if I feel powerless about something that's happening, it really impacts me. And I feel angry. I feel bitter. I feel honestly, like some of the, you talked about, this is weird. Like hysteria, you were talking about like hysteria of like the hypervigilance and just like on edge. When I feel powerless, that happens to me personally.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because what was causing so much of my angst was I wanted to get in a time machine so badly and go back and prevent this.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, and it was driving me crazy. So I think you're exactly right, Charlie. When I met Descendants of Victims, and I was like, oh, I can do something for their, they would, if they could talk to me, they would say, heal my descendants.
There's something really empowering about defining your sphere of influence, mm-hmm. and working within it, and that becomes enough, right? Like, I don't think it's my job to fix everyone's pain who's ever experienced something bad that a church leader has said, or racism in the church, or homophobia, or sexism, but it is my job to empathize and make changes within the sphere of influence that I have.
Yes.
And I've noticed that as I do that, I'm able to let go of bitterness and just be a better disciple of Christ, really mourn with people and correct people in loving ways that leads to growth instead of just staying stuck where I used to be and where others were too.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is exactly right. Like when we take that locus of control and we say, I'm in charge of my destiny and I can, there's something I can do to make this better. I think that is where healing comes.
I've noticed lately that sometimes when people are like, seem to be really stuck on things in the past, I should probably do better at like giving them more space, because there's things that I've worked through personally,
right.
that when other people haven't, I'm just like, oh my gosh, work through it. A lot of people have, like, you could talk to people and figure it out. And then I have to like remind myself, no, like it did take me a while to work through, and I had like loving, supportive people. And, I guess I think that's the thing that maybe I feel most frustrated towards, like taking locus of control, mm-hmm. right? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, well, so I think like going to like tying this all together, you weren't responsible for what happened at Mountain Meadows, and yet no. You felt a responsibility.
Well, okay, now I'll drop that bomb. So after I was involved in all these reconciliation efforts, after the book came out, the first book, after I was started working on Vengeance of Mine, I was years into it. I was looking at my genealogy, and there was a line I wasn't aware of before, but I was looking at that line, and there was a last name that I recognized because I knew the history.
Oh, gosh.
And I looked in the index of Massacre at Mountain Meadows, in which I looked in the appendices, and in which we have a list of the militiamen who participated, and I saw my great-great-great-grandfather there.
What was that like?
Surreal. Absolutely surreal, because not so much just, I mean, it's just shocking enough to find out your ancestor could participate in something so horrific, but also because I felt so compelled to meet descendants of victims, so compelled, and I had done all that, and then to find out I was a descendant of a perpetrator after all that, it was stunning. So I forgot what you were talking about, Ben, because this story related to that, what you were just saying.
Yeah. I don't remember what I asked. But what I'm thinking about now is, you talked about healing for the victims. What does healing look like for the perpetrators and the descendants of perpetrators?
So I talk to people all the time about Mount Meadows, whether it's church members only, but they're not descendants of perpetrators, or perpetrators. And I just tell them, if the only way to move past this is to engage with it, you know, engage with that history, learn about it, own it, not try to deny it, not try and say, oh, well, or not try and excuse it, just own it, and then say sorry, and then be able to move on. And there's an incredible amount of healing that comes from that, and love. And descendants of victims, I've had some of the most wonderful, heartwarming spiritual experiences with them. I mean, some experiences that I'm just so grateful for. And they're some of my dearest friends.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had tried to excuse it or justify it or not talk about it, not look at it, I could have never had those kinds of experiences. Mm-hmm. So it can be painful to engage with history, right? That's what we're talking about on the show. It can be painful. But by engaging with it and then learning from it, we can learn. And I think, again, particularly us as allies, we have a responsibility to learn from you you know, what it's been like, learn about that history so that we can say sorry and embrace you.
Yeah. You know? I think your story shows how much God cares. Like, I think God really cares about pain, and I think God really cares about healing, and how sacred, really, that you felt like this stirring inside of you to care about this and go there, and that you were able to, like, participate in generational healing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And, like, there's something important about generations and DNA and healing and how just this just really amazing that God orchestrated that. And
yeah, and you know what, and like I wasn't planning to do that,
right?
You know what I mean? It just kind of like all fell into my it was just the path I took. But since then, it's been remarkable. I've had people reaching out to me, some people who are descendants of Brigham Young, and they're doing intergenerational healing with people who were enslaved in Utah.
Wow.
And starting these kinds of reconciliation processes after hearing my story. So I was really moved to learn that and to see that other people, there's all kinds of areas in which we need to heal from, right? And so we can all work on intergenerational healing.
Yeah.
You know, my friend Melissa Inouye, she's also a church historian. I heard her say once.
Melissa. Yeah.
I heard her say once that, you know, we're talking about like your actual ancestors. We're talking about like actual descendants of people, but we're all family. Like in the end, like we're all brothers and sisters. Like we're all siblings.
Or we're all Americans.
Yeah. We're all connected. And she said we care about our ancestors so much that we do work for them in the temple. Like we offer them proxy baptisms and proxy ordinances so they can progress and grow. And then I heard her say once, what would it look like to offer to our ancestors proxy repentance? Like to offer them the opportunity to grow and to change.
I totally have felt that. And I don't know. I have no idea if my ancestors on the other side or something prompting me to do that. But if he is, then yeah, I'm glad I was able to be a tool to help him.
Yes.
I don't know. Was he working on me? I don't know.
Yeah, but for you to be able to say like the I'm sorry that he didn't get to say.
Yeah.
Like that feels sacred and not by accident.
I wish I could talk to him. And I wondered about the rest of his life. Did he never wrote anything about it or anything. But I wonder, did he labor under that burden the rest of his life? I don't know.
Well, no. And how, with what you said, Ben, that you understood the context, that you understood what was happening culturally, politically, socially, you probably like know generally what temperature it was that day and what people were eating. And like you know so much about everything that went behind this. I don't want to call it a decision, like reaction, like reaction. This reaction. Mm-hmm. And that he, I don't know, I can't speak for your ancestor, but you know, like with the mistakes I've made and the things that have just made me feel so ashamed, for someone to know what was happening makes it so much more palatable to show.
Mm-hmm.
And that he trusted you with that that proxy forgiveness, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the case with any historical episode. So maybe what would be helpful, like with these quotes, and again, understanding the context never justifies them, never excuses these wrongs, right? But
I think that's, I'm just keep going. I don't want to.
Oh, I was just saying, but putting them in historical context can help us see like, oh, that was the waters they were swimming in.
Yeah.
To say, oh, that was driving those kind of motivations. Again, not, when I say understand, not to like condone it, but to comprehend why someone would say something
with like that. The black and white, it's easy to go like, oh, quit making justifications, right? But it's really, things aren't complex. And at least for me, it helps me depersonalize it for myself. Mm. Like, it's not like Spencer Kimball hates me. Like it just feels different. Like more like he didn't know. The education was different. The motives were different, you know, and it helps it not feel like such a sharpened dagger and more like a blunt hit, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, like not excuse things that happened, but understand them and maybe offer grace, but
comprehend. But, yeah.
But still understand like that doesn't necessarily just take away the hurt.
No.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Just like with Mountain Meadows, when I say, you know, when I speak about it, I always say it's so important to understand the historical context. Right. Not that that excuses what happens, not that that lessens the horrific nature, how wrong it was at all, but just understanding history. I don't know. Something about it just helps us understand the human condition more.
Do you want to retell your Ernest Wilkinson story?
I do.
I think you should. I think it fits perfectly here.
So Ernest Wilkinson was the president of BYU in like the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And he said some things about homosexuals that I think we would probably find very offensive today.
Probably. Definitely.
I'm trying to be polite. And during 2020, during the Black Lives Matters movement and people were talking about, you know, the names of buildings at BYU, and it occurred to me that I worked in a building named after him,
Wilkinson,
and that he wouldn't have wanted me to work there. Like, yeah. I would not have, like, as an openly gay person, I would not have been allowed to work in that building.
You say that really lightly.
Yeah.
Was that an act of defiance for you? Like, hey, well, Ernie, I'm here working.
He wouldn't have wanted, like, he was like, if you have these inclinations, you can get out.
Yeah, and we'll refund your tuition, he said. Yeah.
Take the money and run, Ben.
And so I decided to, like, learn a little bit about him. And I realized that he died before I was even born.
Okay.
And I thought, it's been so many years since he said those things. Mm. And I thought, if he knew me, he would be so thrilled that I was working in a building named after him. And I wanted to believe and assume that he had grown since he said that. That he's continued growing.
Like my ancestor.
Yeah. Continue learning and growing, that he would be, say, I am so honored that Ben Schlatt gets to work in this building. You know, I don't know. I've never talked to him, but.
Yeah, I mean, if Spencer W. Kimball was alive today, what would he say?
Yeah,
would he say, "I'm so sorry, I was wrong." I don't know.
Can I share one more story that I've shared before? This comes from Saints, Volume 2, and it's the story of Susie Young, and she's gotten married, and she's going through a divorce, and her father Brigham Young has died.
Susie Young Gates,
yeah,
and Signature Books just published a biography about her.
Oh, wonderful.
Sorry, shameless plug.
That's cool. So this is in chapter 30 of Saints Volume 2. It says, one night Susie dreamed that she and Alma, her husband, were visiting her father Brigham Young in the Lion House. Brigham Young had an assignment for them, but rather than give it to Alma as he usually did when he was alive, he gave it to Susie. Yeah. As she left to fulfill the assignment, Susie encountered Eliza Snow in the hall. Once again, this is all in a dream. Why had her father given her the assignment, Susie asked, when he had always asked Alma in the past? He did not understand then, Eliza said in the dream, but he does now. Mm-hmm. And then the narrator says, Eliza's words lingered with Susie after she awoke. It was a comfort to realize that her father might have a different perspective in the spirit world than he had had in life.
Oh, I love that.
It's pretty.
Yeah.
And
Spencer W. Kimball didn't understand then, but would he now?
Yeah. And I just wonder, I actually know one of Spencer Kimball's grandsons really well. He's Charlotte's son-in-law. Like, I know how much he loves me and how much he cares about me.
Yes.
And I know that, and I really do believe that if President Kimball came over to the house, he would be like so happy to know me, and he would probably say sorry for some of the hurtful things that happened. And, you know, I don't know that, but that is what I believe would happen. And that doesn't mean I haven't felt pain and hurt in the past, but I just have like a lot of hope for continued growth and healing. And I just think it's so beautiful that you got to offer the words that your ancestor didn't get to. Mm. And we are all like spiritual descendants, like of past people in the church. Like, even if we're not like literal sense, we're all spiritual descendants of those who came. Like, I don't have pioneer ancestors at all. Like, my parents were both converts, but I still feel like those are my people. And I think that we can offer the healing, like, as spiritual ascendants of people who have said harmful things to one another.
I love that.
It's beautiful. I agree.
Yeah. Barbara, there's something I've heard you and Rick Turley say, like, none of us are responsible for what happened, but What is that thing you all
say? Yeah, so none of us today, none of us alive today are responsible for the massacre, but we are all responsible for how we deal with it. So if we seek to excuse it or justify it, then we are just continuing to perpetrate the wrong, mm-hmm. right? But if we, again, as I was saying, engage with it, own it, feel sorrow for it, apologize for it, and accept that it happened and learn from it, that's the only right way to handle something as horrific as a massacre.
Yeah. And I think that applies in this case too. You know, yes. None of us are responsible for things church leaders have said, but we all can make sure we're not excusing things that were said or justifying it, but saying, let's move forward. This is a new time and a new day. And let's do what we can within our control to make sure that people understand and have better information and more love.
And we have the responsibility to learn about it too, to engage with it, to learn about the history, and to reach out and listen to our LGBTQ brothers and sisters and seek to understand your hearts and know what it is to be you, you know, to truly learn from you. And so we have that responsibility for whether we are queer, whether we are white, whether we are black, whether we are male, whether we are female, whether we are non-binary, you know, whoever we are in our identities, we have a responsibility to learn about everybody else and their identities and what it is like to walk in their shoes, no matter who they are or who we are.
Yeah. A walk in my shoes is a great title.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Shameless plug for you. It's a great title.
Yes. You know, I'm thinking about a listener. I'm guessing most listeners aren't currently experiencing pain because of the things we're talking about. I'm guessing that's not the case for most listeners, but I think some listeners probably are going through a painful moment, just like you were when you had that experience on that trip with your friend, Charlie. And I just have felt to say, like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry that you're hurting and in pain, and let's heal together.
Isn't that what Jesus taught?
Yeah, and I guess advice I would give is to, like, really check your own locus of control and see what you're doing to work through it personally and heal. Mm-hmm. And even if others aren't supporting you in that, or you feel like it's like an impossible task, it's worth showing up for yourself, mm-hmm. and it's worth like empowering yourself when you feel disempowered.
Yeah.
I wanted to share something that I've been feeling as well. I've been editing a book titled Chosen Path, a memoir by historian D. Michael Quinn. And I don't know if any of your listeners would have heard of him, but he's certainly well known in the Mormon historian community. He was a leading historian of church history, and he promoted, starting in the 1970s, being more open and talking about all these aspects of church history that were previously taboo, not safe to talk about. He said, let's talk about them. And the way where we are with church history today is largely because of D. Michael Quinn. We stand on his shoulders. He was also a pioneer in that he was a gay man, a gay, devout Latter-day Saint who loved the church, believed until the end, but he was excommunicated for his views and for who he was. If he were alive today, I think he would be so happy to see how things are changing. And the reason why I can say I know things are changing is because I just edited this book. Again, he was born in 1944. And I don't know if you two have had a chance to read the
book. I've started reading, but it's very long.
But yeah, I encourage you to read it because when you read that, you'll see, oh my gosh, how far we have come. And again, we still have so far to go. But you will be able to see the march of history and see how things have changed and are changing. And I think he would be thrilled to see what's happening.
Yeah.
Today.
That's nice. It's nice to hear you say that he'd be happy instead of like jealous or bitter. Because, you know, a lot of people, like, it's totally wrong, right? Like, so many of the things he experienced are just, like, it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
I think about how hard it was for me growing up. Like, I can't imagine if I was 50 years older.
Born in 1944.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there's power there, too, to, like, be happy with progress and not upset that you didn't get it. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I hope 30 years from now or 50 years from now, I can look back and be like so happy for the kids growing up rather than jealous that I didn't have the same experience.
Mm-hmm. I think it's hard. I took, so a dear friend of mine is Darius Gray, who's a Black Latter-day Saint leader, and he joined the church in the 60s.
Yeah.
Long before the priesthood ban was lifted. And
well, I think I started saying this, it was an exaltation ban.
You know, priesthood and temple.
Right. It's just, exactly. It's like
both, yeah.
You're banned from exaltation.
Yeah, exactly. So I took to lunch a Black friend of our son's who had just got called on a mission, and he didn't have a lot of family in the church, and so I wanted him to meet Darius. So we all went to lunch, and that was the first time it really hit me. And Darius said to this young man, he looked at me and said, I don't think he said, I'm so jealous. He says, but you're so privileged to be able to serve a mission I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy for you that you are able to do that now, what I was not able to do. You know, Godspeed.
Yeah. So beautiful. So complicated.
So complicated. But I know it must be painful for him too. I do think if Mike could see what you have today, he would be thrilled. I do think that.
Well, I think the moral of the story is to meet the ancestors of the people who hurt your feelings.
Go to lunch with them.
You mean the descendants?
The descendants.
Or you can have seances. Sorry.
Yes. Find the ancestor, meet the descendant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise and personal story and your feelings.
Thank you for inviting me. I really am truly honored, and I've just really enjoyed the experience of listening to you talk and being able to meet you too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you have enjoyed this or other episodes, please consider leaving a review, following us on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube at Questions from the Closet, or sharing this podcast with someone you love. And as always, please remember that we do not represent the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Brigham Young University. We're not trying to be prescriptive or tell anyone what to think or what to do.
You heard three perspectives, and there are many, many more. We encourage you to listen to other voices and hear a wide variety of experiences. If you would like to submit a question or share a comment about today's episode, you can email us at questionsfromthecloset@gmail.com.
Until next time.